Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Financial Services and E-Commerce Practice Group, was recorded on Thursday, August 14, 2014, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Good afternoon, and welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call for the August 2014 Consumer Financial Protection Bureau update. My name is Christian Corgan, and I'm Director of Publications here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, and also that this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. And so without any further ado, I'm going to go ahead and turn the call over to Wayne Abernathy, who is the Executive VP for Financial Institutions Policy and Regulatory Affairs at the American Bankers Association. So, Wayne, go ahead and take it from there. You've got it.
Great. Thank you very much. And good morning or good afternoon, depending on where you're located in the United States at this time, or even if you're calling from outside the United States. Good to have you on the call. Thank you for joining us today. Today I'm also joined by Jerry Lozier, who's of counsel with Winston & Strawn. Jerry is joining us from Chicago. Both of us are members of the Executive Committee of the Federalist Society's Financial Services Practice Group, and Jerry leads our working group on the Consumer Bureau. This teleform is the second of what may become a series in updates on the activities for the new Consumer Bureau. Since our update last month, our colleague on today's call, Jerry Lozier, has cataloged 28 notable Bureau events and activities through about the first part of this week. Today we plan to focus on several of the most notable out of that list, and after we're done with that part, then we will certainly be happy to take calls and inquiries, questions to discuss any of these issues further, or to go into any of the other items maybe we didn't mention, but which may be of particular interest to you, which you think others should take note of as well. And with that introduction, I'm going to dive right into the first item, and we're going to go through five key issues, and then we'll be ready to go into your calls, your questions, your comments, your observations to follow up on what we present. First item I'm going to lead off with is the Bureau's proposed new chat room or financial gossip feature that they have proposed. On July 15, the Bureau released a draft policy statement, and it's important that I stress the word policy statement. This is not a regulation. At least they don't propose it as one. They claim that this is just a policy statement that they're putting out. And under this policy statement, it would permit consumers to opt in to have public access to the complaints that they file, and not just the details of the complaints specifically that have been shared by the Bureau for some months now, but also a narrative that the consumer would like to add to give color or expression to the complaint that they have filed. This is, as I mentioned, just a policy statement. The Bureau does allow comment. They're offering comment, and they don't believe they need to offer comment, period, but they say that they're offering it to improve the input. Initially, there was a 30-day comment period. That period has been extended for an additional 30 days into the third week of September. The proposal would say that people who issue complaints can make their complaints public if they opt to do that, but their names would not be identified of the consumer, but the name of the financial institution that they're complaining of would be made public. The company would also have the opportunity under the proposal to have side-by-side with that complaint any response that they believe they'd like to make public. The Bureau says that under the proposal they would plan to vet the proposal to one extent, and that's to make sure, as far as they can, that the complainant truly is a customer of the institution against which the complaint is being lodged. They call this an unstructured consumer complaint narrative. A couple more details on it. The Bureau says that they are doing this because consumer, civil rights, and other open government groups have been supporting this idea. And they do say that the Bureau itself will not be verifying the validity of the complaints. They will say, quote, they will allow, quote, the reviewers to assess the validity of the complaints, end quote. They don't seem to feel that that is in any way weighted one side or the other by the fact that the Consumer Bureau's website at the very top has the phrase, an official website of the United States government. By the way, I've checked all of the other financial regulatory agencies. None of them have a motto like that at the beginning of their website, but the Bureau does, an official website of the United States government. Trade groups and industry commenters have uniformly opposed the idea of making this information public with the view that the information would receive some kind of imprimatur of the federal government and would provide potentially misleading information if the information that's being provided is inaccurate. It could harm not only the financial institution, but also customers who, or potential customers who would be misled by inaccurate information that is being put there. The Bureau does say they will be careful to try to protect privacy concerns, although they don't give an ironclad guarantee that that will happen. Two more points to make with regard to the proposal. In the draft proposal, they describe the purpose of expanding this database in the following words, quote, this could lead to increased use by advocates, academics, the press, and entrepreneurs, which itself would lead to increased consumer contacts with the Bureau, end quote. And the second point that I would like to make in connection with this is there doesn't seem to be an acknowledgement that unlike Angie's List and some of the other types of consumer websites that do allow complaints to be put up, none of those carry the imprimatur of the federal government. In this case, this does. And they don't seem to think that that's a problem. In comments, I suspect people will be raising that concern. So that's all I'll say about that at the moment, and pass the baton over to Jerry Lozier for our second issue we'd like to lay on the table. And again, we will have time after we've laid out these five issues for any comments, thoughts that you may have. Go ahead, Jerry.
Thank you, Wayne. I'm going to briefly talk about two developments. One has to do with a proposed regulation under the Home Mortgage Disclosure Act, and the second has to do with a report the CFPB released on overdraft fees. First, on the Home Mortgage Disclosure Act, everyone uses the acronym HMDA when we talk about that, and the proposal from the CFPB is really an example, I'm afraid, of the imposition of pretty heavy regulatory burden, and you'll jump out at you when I tell you what's in it. The Home Mortgage Disclosure Act was enacted in 1975, and its concern was that banks were not lending in certain geographic areas. They were essentially redlining, and therefore the solution was to require banks to provide public information on the home mortgage loans they were making so that public officials and citizens could identify banks that were not doing what they were supposed to do. Over time, the statute has been expanded to cover non-bank mortgage lenders, and eventually it has become a tool for ferreting out unlawful discrimination in a residential mortgage lending. The statute requires a lender to compile and disclose every year loan data by each residential mortgage loan application it receives, the loan amount, the census tract, the income of the borrower of the applicant, the race of the applicant, the age, and the gender. So that information is all public on a loan-by-loan basis. So that data serves currently as a basis for a preliminary suspicion that a bank may not be lending to minorities as much as other banks because the data is all out there. In 2012, just to give you a sense of the burden, in 2012, 7,400 lenders reported on 18.7 million loans in their HMDA data. And the CFPB over the last couple of years has imposed fines on banks that have had errors in their HMDA data, inaccurate data. On July 24th, the CFPB proposed to amend the HMDA regulation. The notice they published on July 24th is 573 pages long. It's partly responsive to the 2010 Dodd-Frank Act, which requires the CFPB to adopt a regulation to start require the publication of information on 17 additional data items related to each individual residential mortgage loan. Property value, for example, term of the loan, total points and fees, duration of an introductory interest rate, applicant's age, applicant's credit score, applicant's debt-to-income ratio, the interest rate, the total discount points, and eight other data fields are required by the statute to be added to what's currently published. So you'll get a sense of the CFP proposal burden. In addition to those 17 additional data fields that would be required by statute, CFPB has proposed in its regulation to require 20 additional data fields. So essentially 37 additional data fields that will have to be required to be published for each individual loan residential mortgage loan application that a lender gets. The regulation would also expand the scope of the reporting to include reverse mortgages and open-end lines of credit. And it also proposes that rather than reporting annually as under the current requirement is, that in the case of the lender that originates more than 75,000 mortgage loans a year, and that covers apparently about 28 lenders, they would have to report not annually, but quarterly. So that's the HMDA proposal. On the overdraft fee report, it was issued on July 31st, and it reports that the average overdraft fee is $34. The majority of these overdraft fees apparently involve transactions of $24 or less that are repaid within 3 days. And CFPB Director Richard Cordray, in an interview, said that if these overdraft fees were interest, the annual rate would exceed 17,000%. In 2010, the bank regulators concerned about overdraft fees required banks to offer consumer depositors the right to opt in if they wanted overdrafts covered that would be caused by transactions at ATMs or by the use of debit cards. If you opted in, to have that overdraft coverage, of course, you would be opting in also to pay the overdraft fees. Apparently, 40% of consumers have opted in, but the CFPB report says its next focus will be on what consumers are told when they're offered the chance to opt in, the implication being that the opt-in may not be an informed opt-in and therefore is not really bona fide. So that will be the next issue, it appears, on the overdraft fee front. Wayne, how about the allegations of employment discrimination at the CFPB?
Well, thank you very much, Jerry. I know some people consider this the salacious part of our presentation today. This is the continuing saga that burst on the scene toward the end of the winter season of this year. So we're talking about February, March, that the Bureau was being accused of engaging in discriminatory and unfair practices with regard to its own employees. On July 30, the Bureau Director Cordray testified before the House Financial Oversight and Investigation Subcommittee, part of the House Financial Services Committee. And in that testimony, he was focusing on the allegations of discrimination and retaliation against the employees that were raising these concerns. In that testimony, Cordray took responsibility for the alleged discriminatory system. It's not clear what taking responsibility means, but whatever it means, he's taking it. And then he emphasized that the problems really stem from the fact that the Bureau, in the efforts to try to set up an agency in a hurry, did not initially train its managers appropriately. One of the steps that he announced in his testimony that he's taken to address this concern is to a reorganization at the Bureau to have the Office for Minorities and Women Inclusion, OMWI, which is mandated under the Dodd-Frank Act, report directly to him. of course, under the Dodd-Frank Act, it's supposed to report directly to him. So it's, I guess that suggests that it hadn't been before, even though that's a violation of the statute. But he has clarified that, and now that office will report directly to him as required under the law. Cordray also pointed out that more than one independent investigator has looked into the allegations and found them to be incorrect. And one of the investigations, I believe, that he was referring to is a report that he asked the Office of Minority and Women Inclusion at the Bureau to conduct. And that office, on 12th of August, I believe it was, reported back to the Director Cordray with its findings, and it verified that the Bureau had been unclear about its priorities and lacked uniform standards for employee performance. It noted that employees did not understand what the various hiring and promotion and pay practices had been at the Bureau, and that that lack of understanding was contributing to the impression that the decisions were unfair. And noted again that some employees reported unfair treatment based on race and gender, and that to them, the Bureau leaders appeared to be indifferent to the problems. The writer of the report, Stuart Ishimaru, said, quote, "These are not easy matters to ferret out and address," end quote, and then said additionally, "Issues around diversity, inclusion, equality, and fairness will be ongoing challenges for the agency," end quote. Additional developments in connection with that, on the 30th, also on the same day as the testimony, the Washington Examiner reported that the Bureau has hired an Atlanta law firm to re-examine the earlier investigations that had been conducted on the employee complaints, including the allegation that the Bureau was, quote, "a toxic workplace," end quote. The law firm is Hollowell, Foster & Herring, a firm that specializes in defending government agencies faced with employee complaints. And then the last item in connection with this continuing story, on August 1, the Washington Examiner reported that the GAO had responded to a request from House Financial Services Committee Chairman Jeb Hensarling and members Patrick McHenry and Shelley Moore Capito to engage in a study of the organizational culture and personnel management issues at the Bureau. So there'll be additional studies and reports forthcoming. And that's the latest state of play on that issue. And now we go back to Jerry for our fifth and last item, and then we'll open up for comments and questions from all of you listening in. Go ahead, Jerry.
Thank you, Wayne. Wayne, I'm going to talk about an interesting enforcement action the CFPB filed in mid-July against a debt collection law firm in Georgia. It was July 14th, and the case was filed in the U.S. District Court for the Northern District of Georgia, and the law firm was sued, and three of its owners are also defendants. And the law firm apparently collect debts for major credit card issuers and supposedly has sued hundreds of thousands of consumers in the state of Georgia. And the complaint alleges that the law firm has engaged in two violations of the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act. The two prohibitions that arguably or allegedly have been violated here are, one, falsely representing that a communication comes from an attorney, and the second violation of the FDCPA allegedly is that false representations were used as to the character, amount, or legal status of debt. The facts that were alleged are that the law firm operated, quote, "less like a law firm than a factory," unquote. It had an automated system, and the firm had hundreds of non-attorney support staff that were employed to identify potential defendants, determine whether the potential defendants had filed for bankruptcy, determine whether the statute of limitations had expired, what the dates were on the contract they signed, what the dates were of the last payments made, what the principal was owed, what interest was owed, what attorney fees were owed, and this non-attorney support staff would also draft complaints. The non-attorney support staff, this is all according to the complaint, would forward the draft complaints to the firm's 8 to 16 attorneys, but these attorneys were expected to spend less than 1 minute to review and approve each individual complaint, and that the attorneys also did not verify the allegations of fact in the complaint. The firm also used affidavits to support the complaints, and the CFPB complaint alleges that the affidavits that were used were signed by people without personal knowledge of the fact being attested to. And allegedly, the firm collected millions of dollars annually, including amounts that actually were not really owed by consumers. So again, now with those facts in mind, recall the allegations are that this law firm, in its communications, made false representations that the communications were from an attorney. And the argument of the CFPB is that attorneys were not really meaningfully involved, even though on its face the communications came from the law firm. The second allegation under the FDCPA, remember, was that false representations regarding the debt were made, and the basis, the CFPB basis for that was that these affidavits were supposedly baseless. The law firm apparently had cooperated with the CFPB up to the filing of the complaint, and it says it denies the allegations in the complaint and presumably will defend vigorously. So more to come on that, Wayne.
Thank you very much, Jerry. And with that, we're ready to, as I say, we're working. Those are five highlights out of a list of 28. We're happy to talk about any one of those or any of the other items on the list of 28 or something that might be of concern to you. So we're ready now to go to comments from our listeners.
All right. Well, for those of you listening, in a moment you'll hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After that, to ask a question, press star and then the pound key. That's star and then the pound key.
Great, thank you. As we're waiting for the calls to line up, I thought I'd touch on item number 15 of our list, and we're, again, certainly happy to talk about any of these items. Item number 15 deals with a provision of the Dodd-Frank Act that many people have shook their heads about and wondering whether or not there's a real opportunity for abuse, and that is, unlike many other agencies, the Bureau is able to retain a significant portion of the fines and penalties that it assesses and place them in what's called a Consumer Financial Civil Penalty Fund. The fund is used either to reimburse people that have been harmed by improper actions of various financial institutions, or be used for financial educational purposes. The Government Accountability Office was asked to study how the Bureau actually manages that fund, and on July 28, they issued a report on how the Bureau might improve the transparency of the civil penalty fund activities. And they said in particular the Bureau had not documented the factors it considers in allocating the funds to financial literacy. And the Bureau and the GAO suggested that in doing so, the fund violates federal internal control standards. So just another little tidbit there for you as we're waiting to see if there are any callers that have questions or comments.
Well, we have a quiet audience today, Wayne. So, again, if you're out there and you'd like to ask a question or make a comment, offer your thoughts, press star and then the pound key.
Great. Thank you very much. Well, I did have one other that I wanted to touch on, if I may, as we're waiting to see if there are any comments or questions. Item number 28 on the list of 28, and the list is not in order of importance. It's more or less chronological, as I recall, if I'm not mistaken, Jerry.
Yes,
Item 28 is the Bureau has issued a consumer advisory about virtual currencies such as Bitcoin, XRP, and Dogecoin. And the advisory is beware. Be careful that you could lose money, that these are the targets for hackers, that the services provided by using these currencies might be more expensive than cash, particularly once the exchange rates are considered, and that there are fraudulent opportunities involved, and that the custodians may or may not be reliable. And that was issued by the Bureau on just the first this week on Monday, August 11th. Any comments or questions from our listeners
Yeah, Wayne, I think this this audience is particularly quiet today. You guys must have done a particularly exceptional job explaining everything earlier.
Very well could be, or we've overwhelmed them with the wealth of things going on at the Bureau.
Actually, something that came to mind for me is speaking of this virtual currency, I mean, is that something that you think the Bureau is going to get more and more involved in over time as currencies like Bitcoin become more popular?
I think they may. I think the challenge for the Bureau is to figure out where it has the authority to do that. One would have thought that currency kinds of issues and the payment system belong to the Federal Reserve. But then again, the Bureau is given a pretty wide mandate. But I think that's going to be the real challenge, is whether or not the Bureau feels comfortable taking actions in this area. Issuing a warning or an advisory is one thing. Taking any kind of enforcement action, they might want to have a clearer grant of authority to do that. And maybe, and that's not untypical for the Bureau, the action they take might be together with one of the other regulatory agencies. Most of the enforcement actions that the Bureau has taken to date has been a joint action together with the Comptroller of the Currency or the FDIC or other agencies.
Wayne, Jerry Lozier here. Can I just add one thing to that point? You know, the CFPB can get involved in this Bitcoin issue, but there are so many public policy questions raised by it, and many of them vastly far outside the scope of the CFPB, questions about use of Bitcoin to launder proceeds of crimes, anti-money laundering concerns,
right.
Tax concerns, securities law concerns. It sort of cries out for a comprehensive addressing, if you will.
I think that's right. So I would say that action taken by the Bureau is probably not inappropriate, and I don't think they went beyond their remit. It's probably, you might think, as I did, that they were stating kind of the obvious, but as you know, there are varieties of financial literacy amongst the population in general, and so putting out a caution is probably not a bad idea.
Mm-hmm.
Well, again, for any of our callers, don't be shy. If you want to offer your thoughts or ask a question, press star and then the pound key. We do have a few dozen people on the line, so... We've got a very captive audience. That apparently, they just are too shy to ask questions today.
Well, that's very good. I don't want to go through the whole list because you get pretty technical here. Although, do we have some really very interesting things? To me, because I live and breathe this stuff day in and day out, I might mention one other that I found particularly interesting, and that is the Bureau making very clear. Adding to what a lot of other agencies have done as well, that the Bureau will, for those states that have recognized same-sex marriage, that their ban on discrimination based on marital status will also apply to same-sex marriages, and they'll be investigating to see, make sure that where that regime is in existence, that financial institutions are not committing violations in that regard. I don't think that's unusual compared to what a lot of other federal agencies are doing, but that was an announcement that they made on July 11th.
Mm-hmm. Wayne, Jerry Lozier here. I might just add one other interesting tidbit. On July 15th, the CFPB announced that it's going to hold a roundtable in California on how debt collection issues affect Latino consumers, the concern being that some Latino consumers do not have proficiency in the English language, and therefore applying normal debt collection practices to them may not be fair.
Well, I do note that the Bureau has their information provided in both English and Spanish, and I believe they've done that since the beginning of their website. So I can understand that this is a continuing concern at the Bureau and a continuing interest that they've had.
Mm-hmm.
Anything else jump out at you, Jerry, that we might want to share with our listeners?
Well, the only thing that's a piece of good news, Wayne, is that Senators Toomey and Donnelly have introduced a bill in the U.S. Senate that would exempt banks under $50 billion in total assets from CFPB examination authority. And CFPB Director Cordray has publicly said that he would have no objection to that. So that would relieve the burden from banks between $10 billion and $50 billion, because currently the CFPB exam authority extends to all banks with assets of more than $10
billion. Well, that's very interesting, too, because we've had in recent weeks Federal Reserve Governor Tarullo point out that he thought some of those artificial thresholds that are in the Dodd-Frank Act might not accord with reality very well, and we're due for having a second thought and perhaps some amending. So that certainly ties in with that kind of feeling that these numbers maybe ought to be rethought through, and that would not significantly reduce the number of institutions that the Bureau has to supervise, probably by maybe 50 or so, but it certainly would allow them to focus on the much larger institutions.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, all institutions would remain subject to the rule writing by the Bureau.
Yep. Wayne, one last thing would be, it's been an ongoing hot button at the CFPB, the relationship between banks and universities, where universities help banks market their products to students. And so a while back, the CFPB urged banks to voluntarily post on their websites copies of their agreements with universities, and most banks, I guess, have not actually done that. And at the end of our reporting period in early August, the CFPB came out with a blog post criticizing banks that are hiding this information from the public and are fearing the transparency that's been requested by the CFPB.
I'm not aware of other agencies that rely upon their blog as much as the Bureau does for making significant policy statements.
I know. You can propose a regulation or just post a blog.
Yeah. That issue, of course, is also being looked at pretty closely by the Department of Education currently, and they're actually wielding some potential regulation in this area.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and very controversial, by the way, as well. Well, I think those are some of our highlights. Maybe we have one last shot here, see if anyone has any comments or questions. We're happy to respond to those.
All right, so last call for questions. Press star and then the pound key. Well, a particularly shy and well-behaved audience today.
Very much. We certainly appreciate all of you who have called in, listened to what we've had to report. We certainly are happy to continue to share our views as we monitor what's going on with this new experiment in governing here in Washington that we call the Consumer Bureau. And appreciate your participation and sharing. Jerry, it's been a pleasure to work off of your excellent list.
Thank you very much.
Any final thoughts, Jerry?
No, thanks very much, though, Wayne. I really appreciate it.
Well, this is Christian. On behalf of the Federal Society, I want to thank Wayne and Jerry for joining us on the call, preparing the material, and as always, providing a great update. And I imagine we'll be doing more of these in the coming months. So you can find this podcast, as well as our previous podcast from prior telephone conference calls, on our website at fedsoc.org. And we look forward to seeing you on the next call.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.